This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
In the new Netflix science fiction series, Three Body Problem, a killing that takes place during the Chinese Cultural Revolution sparks a chain of events that puts humanity at risk. When the world's leading scientists start dying in mysterious ways, five friends just might be the key to saving the world. Eventually, Three Body Problem showrunners include the famously infamous team behind Game of Thrones, who are once again adapting a beloved epic book series. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about Three Body Problem on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Now more than ever, your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, all tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the strength and stability of a top 10 commercial bank, their dedicated experts work with you to build lasting success. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial, a member FDIC.
Joining me today is Kristen Meinzer. She co-hosts The Daily Fail, a podcast that does comedic close readings of the tabloids. Welcome back, Kristen.
Thanks for having me back.
Always good to have you. And also with us is entertainment journalist Christina Escobar. She's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of LatinaMedia.co. Welcome back, Christina.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And making his pop culture happy hour debut is Jeff Yang. He's a cultural critic and author of The Golden Screen, the movies that made Asian America. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you. I'm so excited.
Well, we're excited to have you. So let's get to it. Three Body Problem focuses on five friends who studied under the same physics professor at Oxford. When that professor dies for mysterious reasons, the five friends get caught up in a conspiracy that involves three things. One, the sudden deaths of other scientists like her. Two, the fact that physics itself doesn't seem to work anymore. And three, a virtual reality game that drops the player into the pulse-pounding thrill ride that is calculating planetary orbits. Three Body Problem was brought to Netflix by creators David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, the Game of Thrones guys, along with Alexander Wu. And it's based on the first book of the internationally best-selling science fiction series known as The Remembrance of Earth's Past trilogy by Liu Cixin. It's streaming on Netflix. Kristen, kick us off. What'd you make of it?
I really enjoyed this. I was sucked in immediately. This is a very high-budget show. It's a very beautiful show. It's incredibly immersive. Mm-hmm. The first scene is so incredibly intense. We're dropped into the Chinese Cultural Revolution while we watch an incredibly violent and emotionally intense moment of a physicist being killed and his daughter being haunted by that. And I just was immediately there. Mm-hmm. I was all in. And then it did something miraculous for me. It cuts to the present. Yep. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going to hate this. They're going to do this jumping back and forth thing. But the present is just as fascinating to me in this story because what is this mystery? What is causing these various brilliant minds to not want to be alive anymore? What is going on with different types of physics that seem imaginary, but maybe they're real and maybe they don't work anymore? All of the things that you alluded to, Glenn. I really loved the characters. I loved the mystery around it. I thought it looked great also.
Okay. That's a yes. Jeff, also a yes?
An emphatic yes.
Okay.
Have to say, I come to this having read quite a while ago, actually, the original book, and finding it eventually fascinating, but sort of slow to uptake. And I kind of feel like the Netflix version not only does justice as an adaptation, but solves some of the problems. Mm-hmm. It does, as Kristen mentions, put that shocking Cultural Revolution scene up front. Mm-hmm. But it also, I think, even in compressing the book, actually gets us to the most interesting stuff about it, the big ideas, faster. Mm-hmm. Frankly, this is like nerd jubilee. You will believe math is fun, you know? So it's perfect for me. It's a fastball down the center.
Okay, great. All right, two yeses. Christina?
I'm not going to give an emphatic yes. Overall, I liked it, but I felt like there were some problems in pacing. There were like two episodes that were very slow towards the end.
Okay.
I agree. I thought the first episode, which I got to catch at South By, was beautifully paced and had a really great balance between the two timelines. But as the show went forward, we spent more time in the present and less time in the past. And I missed the past. I wanted more there. I wanted more of that character and that exploration. So I got a little less loving of it as it went on, but I stayed till the end and I, you know, overall I did enjoy it.
I just want to jump in and say, Christina, I do agree with you that there are a couple of slow episodes toward the end, but the final episode does pick up energy again, even though it then just leaves us on a cliffhanger. Spoiler.
Yeah, I think what we might be reacting to there is that episode 5 has a big, very violent set piece. It is the Red Wedding of this series that people who know the books are going to be waiting for, and they're going to be like watching their friends' faces as it happens. And then after that, it is such a big thing that happens that, it does feel a little like there's some lassitude in those follow-up episodes. Let me tell you, I think this succeeds as a work of adaptation, up to Jeff's point. I really agree. Mm. Does it work as a show? I'm less convinced. Does it work as drama? I think you guys are going to have to pitch me on this because, look, the book is a work of such big, intriguing ideas. What it doesn't have within a million miles of it is an actual believable character. And I'm not the first to say this. This is the classic dig against this book. And also the classic dig against hard science fiction, right? I mean, where writers are using dialogue to do work that dialogue shouldn't do. So in that book, people are just constantly throwing thought experiments at each other. And, you know, imagine three objects in asymptotic.
As one does.
As one does. As physicists do, I guess. I don't want to hang out with people who talk like that. Or they do the clumsy overdetermined dialogue thing of like, as you know, you're the world's leading nanotechnician, okay? I did find the book a bit of a slog. But to all of your point, okay, so this is character-driven, theoretically. We get invested in these characters. We follow their fates. But all of us on this episode are in a unique position because even if we've read the books, I don't know who the hell these characters are because they were created for the show. So that is my question to you, Jeff, kicking off with you. You apparently were sufficiently invested in these new characters and what happens to them week to week to stick with it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that the Oxford Five, as they're referred to, they're solidly cast. I actually quite liked Jess Hong as Jin Cheng, who is, of course, the kind of putative protagonist in this first season of the adaptation. If there are more, we'll see. I also really enjoyed John Bradley, who kind of is a returner. He was in Game of Thrones, and here he is as Jack Rooney, the snack king. Mm-hmm. I just got to say, if I had a choice between becoming a theoretical physicist and like owning a snack empire, I'd probably go with the snack empire also.
Sure.
But for me, actually, the core dynamic that really sold me on the show in a lot of ways is the one between Benedict Wong as Da Shi and Liam Cunningham, who plays kind of the head of this shadowy enterprise that's trying to save the world. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the series convinced me that I would watch the hell out of a version of Bond with Liam Cunningham as M and Benedict Wong as 007.
Oh, hey. So that's a great thought. How about you, Kristen? Were you invested in one character over others, or was it all a good mix?
Well, I have to second what Jeff just said about Jess Hong, who plays Jin. Mm-hmm. She is so good. She really shows the internal conflicts she's feeling, the contradictions, the concerns of, you know, I want to do what's best for humanity, but also am I doing the worst things in the world to achieve this? And she does a great job of bringing humanity to this, even when she's talking about absurd things like brains being frozen in jars and being sent to space for hundreds of years. Or when she's talking about what I like to call the bomb rainbow, you know what we're going to do? We're going to send that brain into space by making an arch of one bomb after another after another, the bomb rainbow.
Imagine a series of 1,000 nuclear devices, evenly spaced in distance, stretching from Earth toward the Santi fleet.
But somehow she makes everything seem, if not plausible, I'm still interested in her and her journey. Mm-hmm. I really liked her a lot. And I loved Rosalind Chow. And she's essentially the big Santi loyalist. She's essentially the character who survived the Cultural Revolution. She brings so much heart to this and believability.
And just for listeners, the Santi are the alien threat. They are coming. They'll arrive in about 400 plus years. And they are the looming threat of this series.
Oh, yeah.
Is that you?
In another life, my first job.
You're beautiful.
I was. Time is a mother.
If there was a less skilled actor playing this role, she might just seem like a villain. But we see the trauma that she's gone through. We see the curiosity. We see her attempts to reach the aliens as also in some ways a way to avenge her father, who loved science, who was incredibly curious, and he was killed for that. And in a way, she's continuing her father's journey. So she's not just a villain, and she does such a great job of being all of these things at once. And yes, I second also what Jeff said about Benedict Wong being the next 007. I loved every scene he was in.
I agree. This show would not have worked without Jess Hong. Like, her ability to bring heart and humanity to a character that could have been very stiff made this show work. It gave you someone to root for, someone to understand, someone to empathize with. Her part was so, so strong. The other thing that I appreciated about how they did the Oxford Five, they weren't too precious with it. You know, like in Walking Dead, where they just kill off your favorites left and right. I was like, oh, I see. We're playing in a different TV universe where, you know, people can die. The moonshots can fail. Like, this isn't the same sort of typical show that we're in, which felt good and surprising, especially when some of the episodes maybe got a little slower. So I definitely appreciated that. And I also, I mean, Rosalind Chow, I've been watching her since I was a little kid on Next Generation, and seeing her in this role, getting to play such a meaty, complex character, I loved it.
And it's interesting because, I mean, when you divide one character into five or you create others out of whole cloth, you let them have their little internal rivalries and the little romances, which is drama. But that's my next question, because is there enough drama in the science fiction itself? Because the threat is 400 years off plus, right? That's the interesting thing. That's the whole idea here. But that is both a feature and a bug, right? Feature, because it's great to think about it. What would humanity do? Bug, where's the urgency? What is so important about these people that we need to stick with them when actually this conflict that's coming does not have any direct impact on their day-to-day lives at all? They're going to have kids who are going to have kids who are going to have kids. Is there enough urgency to carry this show through three seasons week to week, Jeff?
Just a reminder, when you say, is it a feature or a bug? We are bugs. So
We are bugs. I forgot about that. Good point.
I think that one of the things that is true about the way they've done this adaptation is a lot of the drama actually comes from the moral dilemmas, the kind of tension in each of the characters between what they want to do, what they should do, what they feel they have to do, and ultimately what is best for humanity, which is a range of different sacrifices each of them has to make. I mean, you begin actually with Rosalind Chow's character, you know, Ye Wen Jie herself. Her whole kind of pitching down the path in which she ultimately just decides that humanity itself is lost comes from the fact that she has had personal harm from this act of just crazy fanaticism that was the Cultural Revolution. But the division between Yang Wenjie, played by Xin Seng, and Rosalind Chow really shows that evolution of how somebody who's harmed by idealism could actually become a fanatic herself. That really made that arc really work for me. But each of the characters has a very similar push and pull between the things they really want to be doing and spending time with and, again, their ultimate fate.
I guess I feel like by short shrifting or not giving as much space to the earlier timeline, we miss a lot of those complicated questions. And I really wanted to see them because I do think that there was an interesting parallel between what our heroine turned villain is doing, what she's thinking, her moral choices that she has to make, and then the narrative she must have had to have told herself after she made them, right, mm-hmm. and continues on. I would have loved to have seen equal time with her as with the Oxford Five, and I think it would have made more of a case for why to set it at this moment when you have one character who's learned of the existence of these aliens who are coming, and then another, the whole world learning at the same time. And that would be a pivotal moment, right, in this journey. But I think where the show falters a little bit is it starts off with them parallel in that first episode, and then it drops it, mm-hmm. which felt like a missed opportunity for me to really delve into the really interesting moral questions, which I think is what makes science fiction so meaty to watch.
Well, when I think about the 400-year timeline, the first thing that popped into my head was a parallel to climate change.
Right.
How urgent should we be treating climate change right now, knowing that, you know, we're not all going to die right now or next week or next year, but it will happen. Should we be treating it as urgent now? And a lot of people feel like, no, we shouldn't. In my heart, I'm like, yes, we absolutely should be treating this like the catastrophe and threat that it is. Mm-hmm. But there was this other thing I thought was really interesting, which was mm-hmm. what the Santi are doing to scientists on Earth right now is so torturous and terrible that even if we never get to 400 years, they're essentially causing people to go mad on Earth, to see things that are not there. They're causing people to be injured very badly or to die. And I also was thinking about that 400-year threat. It's not 400 years from now. Right now, it's actually happening to people.
True that. Yeah. One of the biggest leaps I want to talk to you about is in setting and cast. I mean, it's gone from being a work set largely in China with a lot of Chinese characters that brings in a lot of Chinese history, recent and ancient, to a work that is now set in the UK, and it features a pretty diverse cast, but also a lot of Anglo-Asian characters. Mm-hmm. That was a very deliberate change that does not exist in a vacuum. That can't help but bring all kinds of political, cultural elements into the mix. Jeff, you have some thoughts on this, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some ways, because Netflix doesn't actually air in China, you know, mm-hmm. it was able to do certain things that brought to life scenes from the book or ideas in the book that probably could not have played and certainly were not displayed in the 30-episode other adaptation, the Chinese one. For instance, the Cultural Revolution being as just violent and horrific as it was, that's something that is new to this adaptation, putting it right up front. Otherwise, you know, could not have happened in China. The other thing about the broader casting and the bringing it into a global as opposed to a primarily Chinese cast is it makes uh-huh. it feel more like a global threat. It also allows us to see diversity, even in a cast that still has a kind of plurality of Asian actors in it. Uh-huh. We do see very kind of notable differences in their storylines and their characters, but also in the way that they're portrayed. And I think it's really important because a lot of times we tend to think, oh, well, if you're going to see Chinese actors, you know, you can't have more than two or three of them on screen at the same time because people won't be able to tell them apart. When I say we, I mean Hollywood. I've never felt that.
Sure.
I can recognize yeah. the difference. But even with the Anglo-Chinese characters, there are very core differences in everything from their accents to their kind of viewpoints. And it just makes for a very different kind of diversity and one that I very much welcome. Mm-hmm. Well, I have a question for Christina. I just was reading an interview with Eiza Gonzalez where she talks about saying that she really appreciated being cast as a scientist because, you know, being too hot has been a challenge for her. Her role is an interesting one, and she was purposely cast, I think, again, to globalize this with an actor who is Latina. And I'm wondering what you thought about her portrayal.
I had mixed feelings. I mean, I'm rooting for her. I was rooting for her character. I liked that they gave her a different type of moral compass than some of the other characters, right? She's kind of struggling in a way some of the others aren't. Mm-hmm. But I felt like the show didn't quite do her the solid they should have. Like, her friendship could have been bigger. I felt like it was meaningful and interesting. And like, how often do you see like lady scientist friends on TV saving the world? Like never, right? And so I wanted a little bit more of that. And I guess a little bit less of her like throwing up in her underwear, like not necessary. We could tell she was beautiful without that, right? So I felt a little bit like they were trying to have their cake and eat it too. And it made me not be able to root for it, I guess, 100% quite how I wanted to.
Let me get a tone check from all three of you because can we talk about the VR stuff, the VR game? Mm. It's a little goofy, right? Don't get me wrong. The headset looks dope. I love that headset. I love everything about it. I would wear it to the Met Gala. But the game itself, kind of goofy. I mean, these aliens turning themselves into fruit roll-ups, that's supposed to be a big like, you know, or the big climactic moment when the king shouts the word rehydrate. And props to the actor because he's giving it his all. But rehydrate is one of those words that's really hard to invest in any kind of gravitas. It just doesn't have – it's hard to do. And when Jack is around, you know, the character played by John Bradley, to kind of call out some of the goofiness, I think the show's a lot more fun. When he goes away, are we supposed to take the VR game seriously, Kristen?
I'm a little biased here. I already think video games are silly. They just are to me. I don't hold them in super high regard. I know that there are some video games that are considered artistic, that are considered great for their narrative. But at the end of the day, to me, I'm like, it's a game. And so I gave it a pass because these are aliens trying to speak to scientists through one of their nerdy hobbies. Scientists like video games. And I'm like, if it was something that they were trying to do IRL instead and all of this was happening, I might have more of an issue with it. But again, it's video games, which are silly.
It was either video games or Sudoku.
I will say it was helped, though, that it was so visually beautiful. Like, yes, screaming rehydrate. Silly.
It's just, but I can't.
When the first character lays down and is dehydrated and shrinks, like how they handled that visually was pretty cool. Like in some of the costumes and the sets and all of those pieces, like I actually felt like they did, like imagine if that had been a low budget, how you would have felt about it.
That's true.
It would have been unwatchable. So like the beautiful visuals along the way kept me going through. But I also, I guess the other thing I thought that was interesting was they have the contrast with that, with the Mortal Kombat type game, right?
That's true.
And that one's even more silly.
I think the goofiness actually really did lighten up in some ways what would otherwise be just a very heavy set of ideas to tussle with.
Yeah, I was concerned that there wasn't enough there for this, that the urgency was too abstract for me to carry into a second season. But you're all on board for a second season, right?
Yeah, to the point where I was kind of mad the way this ended. I was like, come on.
It does end suddenly.
Give us 10 more episodes. Tell us what's going to happen. What's going to happen with this brain in space? Are they going to make another bomb rainbow? Come on.
I know. I almost would have, having watched the whole thing, would have ended it on the end of episode 5, put in more of the back half, and then saved. Because that, those next two episodes felt like the beginning of a new season with like a whole new set of problems. It didn't quite work on that front, but I definitely think there will be and shall be and probably needs to be more because the story definitely is unresolved and there's enough sort of beauty and intrigue to keep us going.
I mean, this is the first book in a trilogy, right? So there is definitely lots more story. And if you're disappointed in not getting resolution after 8 episodes, can you imagine actually going through 30 episodes and arriving at the same point? Because that's what Chinese watchers got. Obviously, we should, and I think we will see additional seasons of this. The one thing which actually kind of blows my mind is that Netflix, in all of its wisdom, decided to change the title of the series a little bit from its original. They now use a number, the numeral 3 body problem. And you just know so many Americans have already been trained to look at numbers and say, oh, those are sequel markers. This is actually the third, not the first.
I didn't see one body problem, so I can't. Well, that's us. That's the four of us, three gung-ho, one a little less gung. We want to know what you think about Three Body Problem. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Kristen Meinzer, Jeff Yang, Christina Escobar, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was a great group. This episode was produced by Hafsa Fatham and edited by Mike Katzeff and Jessica Reedy, and Alokam In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.